Today on The Independent, Father Nate Wills, the Notre Dame team chaplain, joins the show to talk about his job with Notre Dame and the football program. Plus, Pete and I preview the regular season finale at Stanford.
Welcome to the latest episode of The Independent. I'm Pete Sampson of The Athletic, joined by my regular co-host, Matt Fortuna of The Inside Zone. We're recording Thanksgiving week. Notre Dame's regular season wraps up at Stanford on Saturday night on the Pac-12 Network. Good luck finding it if you're not attending the game. I will be out there. Matt will be in Ann Arbor, I think.
I'll be somewhere in a Michigan hotel room somewhere.
Yes,
watching the game of the year and trying to find the other game of the year.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for being with us. You can always find our podcast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube. I think you will enjoy the Father Nate's reaction to my first question. I'll let everyone listen to it to figure out what that first question was, but that was fantastic.
His reaction to all the questions were really good. I mean, he didn't take the bait on my last one, but the man answers to a higher power. And there's something about like, going from Joe Schmidt to him, like the serious level, if you will, is a little bit different when I'm asking questions of an actual priest. It felt like a public confession almost.
Yes. And it was good, good Thanksgiving week guest, maybe more topical around Christmas, but he's a little bit busier then. So
he did break some news with us. Speaking of Christmas,
yes. Yeah,
the prayer medal this week. I won't spoil it. You can listen to the interview, but breaking news on The Independent.
On the news, before we get into Stanford, on the news point, this is more hypothetical news, but considering the state of Notre Dame's defense and how good they've been, I think we referenced the Syracuse job coming open over the weekend. Now Al Golden's name pops up pretty much on every list for Syracuse, sometimes in the number one spot. Matt, I think in the Inside Zone, you wrote about that. So, I mean, you're more plugged into coaching comings and goings than I am. Like, how would you assess the likelihood or not of Al Golden and Syracuse being an interview, being a match, being a place that maybe Al Golden would want to go?
Yeah, it's a good question because I think personally, and you'll have a hard time convincing me otherwise, Syracuse is the worst Power 5 job in the country. I say that as someone from that state, albeit in the city, but it's not exactly a football hotbed. And you're playing in a conference with good teams in Florida and South Carolina, and now teams coming from the West Coast and Dallas as well. So you need to do, traditionally speaking, you need to do something different or outside the box, I think, to succeed there. And for a brief moment in time with Dino Babers' fast offense, they were able to do that. I mean, that 10-win season in 2018 looks more and more miraculous by the day, even if
it was just never the same after he kicked the field goal.
I was just going to say, even if we'll forever have an asterisk in Notre Dame fans' minds because he avoided a shutout at Yankee Stadium. Everything I've gathered so far is they want someone with ACC experience. They want someone with head coaching experience. Al Golden obviously checks both those boxes. He's an East Coast guy. He's from South Jersey, played tight end at Penn State and was a head coach at Temple and really did maybe the greatest modern turnaround in college football history. Now it won't get that credit because it's Temple, but that's a program that was on the brink of literal collapse. They got kicked out, I think, of the MAC, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Or wherever, maybe it was the big, whatever conference they were in, they got kicked out because they were so incompetent. I was at
that's Penn like State. I think we might be confusing Temple and UMass in terms of the conference they got kicked out of, which says something about how bad Temple
UMass did get kicked out of the MAC, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think Temple might have been a different conference.
And UMass is trying to get back into a conference.
Yeah. But is the point being, like, people forget about how bad Temple was at the time. Like, they were terrible, terrible, terrible.
No, when I was at Penn State, they would play Temple every year, and they beat them however many years in a row. It was like Notre Dame Navy almost. And I remember, like, Al Golden played for Joe Paterno, who told him, do not take the Temple job. Like, you're going to end your career here. Like, you cannot win there. And the guy literally turned the whole thing around. I mean, he had 8 or 9 wins in each of his last 2 years. He went from Temple to Miami. Now we can all.
There's a sliding doors world where he's the Notre Dame's head coach and not Brian Kelly.
Yeah. Or Penn State. Everyone thought he was going to be at Penn State, not James Franklin, when he was early on at Miami as well. And that Miami record, while not great, I mean, actually, I wrote this week, it's not really anything better or worse than what's kind of been par for the course in this era of Miami. He went 32-25 in 5 years. amid the fallout of the Nevin Shapiro scandal, with a self-imposed bowl ban, with recruiting uncertainty. You know, Mario Cristobal right now has won 47% of his games at Miami. Manny Diaz was 58%. So it was pretty par for the course there in the modern era of the U. All that to say, like, he's had tougher jobs before. If he wants to be a head coach again, yep, and do it at a place that probably has reasonable expectations, that would be an opportunity to do that. So we'll see what happens there. I mean, he'd be my first call if I were Syracuse, just based on what he's done at Notre Dame these past 2 years. You know, I think the NFL experience before that certainly helps him. You know, he was in a Super Bowl 2 years ago with the Bengals. And again, the guy knows football. He knows East Coast football. Temple, again, like, think about after him. So he goes from there to Miami. Steve Adazio succeeds him, goes from there to BC. Matt Rhule succeeds him, goes from there to Baylor, to the Panthers. And even Jeff Collins succeeded Matt Rhule and went from there to Georgia Tech. Like, that became a pipeline to bigger, yep, jobs simply because of Al Golden. And you're seeing now, now that well's kind of been drained, so to speak, there's nothing left there. It's a really tough job. So we'll see what happens. I'm sure there'll be plenty more firings on Sunday. And, you know, with Notre Dame staff, it wouldn't surprise me if a couple other guys got up for jobs. I mean, look, if Tom Allen gets fired, I think Dylan McCullough will be on their list. Now, I'm not saying he'd be the top choice. Especially, I think being a first-time head coach in the Big Ten is a lot harder than doing it in the ACC. But, you know, it's silly season. It's called silly season for a reason. There's going to be movement all over. Frankly, Notre Dame staff has, at least on-field coaching-wise, very minimal turnover under Marcus Freeman so far, outside of Tommy Rees and Brian Mason, if I'm not mistaken. So,
and Harry Easton. Yeah.
Harry Easton, that's right. But and that was a retirement, too. It wasn't like he left for another job. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, I could easily see Al Golden being in play at Syracuse.
Yeah, we had media access on Monday night because of the short week. And I asked Riley Mills, who came in, just like, hey, what makes Al Golden so good at his job? You know, it's kind of a softball question because they're not, if he wasn't, I wouldn't be asking,
right,
nor would he even give me a legit answer. But, you know, one of the things that I thought was interesting, because I say it's interesting to me because Al Golden to me cuts as a, like, kind of an older school,
right,
personality. And what do we think about older school? Like, kind of like chewing ass on the sidelines. And he said one of the things that really struck him with Golden about is how positive he is all the time, where if there's a problem, he comes over and it's not screaming and yelling, what's up with this problem? It's, okay, how do we fix it? I wonder if there's, like, kind of a pro mentality there now where, like, the riling somebody up just for the sake of yourself, because that's what the stereotypical coach does, like, that doesn't work anymore in 2023. It doesn't work as well. And so he said, yeah, he's always positive. He's very solutions forward. Like, let's coach to the solution, not belabor the problem. And, you know, and he also talked a little bit about, like, he pushes the envelope schematically where, you know, they'll put a lot of stuff in, but if it doesn't work, it's not throw the stuff out. It's like, okay, how can we do a better job of teaching this? How can we go back and, like, master this more than maybe we did the first time around? And I think that, you know, if you're going to have a world of defense in your call sheet, you got to be able to take that and teach it to your roster, which is, you know, we talked about that with Joe Schmidt last week. I think that was Brian Van Gorder's undoing in some ways, where he might know a ton of defense,
right,
but he couldn't teach it. Al Golden knows a ton of defense and knows how to teach it. So I had this in my final thoughts after the week. I was curious how you would rank this. The last six Notre Dame defensive coordinators, how would you rank them in terms of ability as defensive coordinator? Diaco, Van Gorder, Elko, Lee, Freeman, Golden.
Like, when you say, like, basically how good they were at their jobs, like, or
yeah, yeah, how good were they were at their jobs? Not like who had the best head coaching prospects. Yeah. How good were they as Notre Dame's defense coordinator?
I'd probably put Clark one. Not to say he's the best coach of the bunch, because if you look at what he's doing now versus what Elko's doing better, but it's hard to really judge. There's a larger body of work at Notre Dame for Clark Lee. He was there 3 years, and in two of those years, they made the college football playoff. That's pretty freaking good. It's hard not to put Freeman too, just because in his 1 year he got the head coaching job, but I still think a lot of that had more to do with almost his holistic approach and fit than it did with anything tactical he did that year. Because I don't want to shortchange Bob Diaco. The guy took them to the freaking, like, they made the national title game on a great defense,
right?
Yes.
Yeah, he won the Broyles Award. I think I would have Freeman fifth.
Who's sixth?
I think you know who's
but yeah, let's not forget Greg Hudson.
Yeah, no, we can. I wrestled with number one a little bit because it's like, all right, you could Lee had the longest track record of 3 years. They made the playoffs twice.
And they went 11-2 in the non-playoff year.
Yeah, I'm a little bit partial towards Elko just because of the mess he cleaned up and immediately.
Well,
do you give him credit for setting the table for the next three guys too? I don't know. I don't know if that should factor into it.
Elko and Freeman both had 1 year within the context of this conversation. And Elko had more to do. A lot more to do. There's a lower bar to clear for Marcus Freeman. So I think you give Elko the edge based on that criteria.
Okay. So I mean, I think as we're talking this out, I'd probably go Clark Lee one. I might go Al Golden two. Elko three, Diaco four, Freeman five, Van Gorder six. But it's like Diaco, the 2012 defense was incredible.
And he had a lot of cleaning up to do too. I mean, think about how bad of a defense.
But the other three defenses were just good.
Was good. 10 got really good. 10 carried them down the stretch.
Yeah, at the end, 10 was very good.
I would probably go Al 2. Clark 1, Golden 2, Diaco 3, Elko 4, Freeman 5, BBG 6.
It's just incredible to me that, of the six pass defense corners, not that we're, pushing Al Golden out the door, but, five will have gotten head coaching jobs. I guess UConn is not at the Power 5 level. Syracuse would be if Golden got that. Four of them would have been Power 5 head coaching jobs.
Right.
Which is wild. Notre Dame has been blessed and strategic with hiring a really good string of defensive coordinators here. When the season started, I'm not sure I would have anticipated talking about Al Golden in similar terms as those other guys, but man, 100%, he's just killed it at this job. And I remember talking to somebody in the football office when they were going through the hiring process to get Al Golden, and I was like, I said Al Golden, the Miami thing, and he's like, Pete, who's winning at Miami? And I was like, well, that's a good point. No one's winning at Miami.
He had the toughest task of any of the recent Miami coaches when he got there. Got snubbed this week. Was not one of the 15 semifinals of the Broyles Award. A little surprising.
I'm not sure I would have had him in the top five, when it all comes to the end. But I was surprised that he wasn't one of the top 15.
I was too, because rightly or wrongly, I think, and I did not vote this year, but a lot of us who do vote on these things tend to look at who's done the most with the least, right? Like Nick Saban doesn't win too many Coach of the Year awards because it's Alabama and they're good every year. Like Al Golden, I think, has done a lot with the material he's had to work with this year. So that was surprising. I would also say, two things. One, going back to, your reaction to Al Golden initially, which was mirrored mine. There's something to be said for having been there and done that and failed. Right. Like that was my reaction when Illinois hired Brett Bielema. I was like, Brett Bielema, the guy who got fired at Arkansas. It's like, well, he just spent a bunch of time with Bill Belichick. The guy knows football. He's from Illinois. He knows what he's doing. Al Golden knows football.
Always a conversation. I wanted to have that with Al Golden, never have had the chance to. And I don't know if he would even bring, I'm pretty sure he wouldn't want to have this conversation, but what did you learn at Miami? How are you a better, because we only talk about coaches who get better when they win.
Would you learn as a tight end coach on a terrible Detroit Lions team? You know what I mean?
You got to learn a ton from losing. Otherwise, what's the point of losing? It's just a waste. But I would think that if Al Golden becomes a head coach again, what was most informative to him probably will be his time at Miami, maybe even more so than the NFL or Notre Dame.
There's so many next big things, right? Some of them live up to the hype, some of them don't in coaching. I'm absolutely guilty of this. I'm sure others are. Like, once you get fired or fail, I kind of forget about you.
Yeah.
And I don't do that like intentionally. It's a subconscious thing. But like, Sonny Dykes got fired from Cal and took TCU to the freaking national title game last year. You know what I mean? Like, that's not
now we forget he was ever at Cal.
Exactly. Like, but like, you forget, like, again, Brett Bielema, like, he hasn't been coaching college in 5 years. Why would you hire him? Oh yeah, like, the guy's been there, done that, and he's a lot more mature now than he was when he first became a head coach. So yeah, I can easily see Al Golden being an attractive head coaching candidate to a lot of different people. And look, maybe he wants to go back to the NFL and be a DC. Maybe he loves it in Notre Dame and wants to come back and be the DC for year three. I don't know. The other part of it too, the success rate has not been nearly the same on the defensive side of the ball. However, like, Notre Dame's OCs have all moved on to greener pastures too. Sometimes in ways we didn't, like, sometimes Charlie Molnar,
a detour to get there, but yeah.
Charlie Molnar got the UMass.
I was saying like Mike Denbrock, like, when he left Notre Dame, it wasn't to go up, it was to go down, but like, he's come back up and now he's one of the 10 or 15 semifinalists for the Broyles Award.
Might have the Heisman winner this year. But like, UMass and UConn, two peas in a pod. Like, Diaco got UConn, Molnar got UMass. Samford got the Western Kentucky job, which was a really good job at the time, yeah, and still is, I think. But you know, that was as an OC who did not call plays for a 4-8 team. Tommy Reese moves on to Alabama with Nick Saban. Might be missing something. You know, LaFleur was a QB coach. I mean,
Chip Long is sort of the one that did it.
Yeah, I know I'm missing someone before Reese. Who am I missing?
Yeah, that would be the one that, like, and I mean, when he was here,
he probably did the best work of any of them at Notre Dame.
He was the final for the Broyles Award as well. Yeah.
Chuck Martin, by the way, it's the other one. Chuck Martin, Miami, Ohio.
Yeah, pretty good run. So when people stress about coordinator hires in Notre Dame, whether that's, well, last year was a time to stress about it, and
they made two bad, one really bad one and one that's still in progress. BBG.
Yeah. But for the most part, if you hire a experienced coach here, they will have success at Notre Dame and then they will move on. Like, it's a great career resume line. I think that's understood in the industry, and you could probably speak to this better than I can, but like, people want to work at Notre Dame. And when Notre Dame is on your resume, people want to hire you because you worked at Notre Dame. It's not just true for athletic directors. I think it's true for football coaches as well. I mean, Lance Taylor is head coach at Western Michigan. Not been a coordinator.
He had not. No, that's a good point. It's another one. I could see Dylan McCullough. I could see a lot of guys on this staff getting good jobs in the near future. But yeah, Lance Taylor's another one I forgot about. And John McNulty got the OC job at BC after what, 1-2 years as tight ends coach in Notre Dame. So yeah, no, I mean, there's that resume carries a lot of weight in the industry. No question about it.
All right. Well, we'll get into our interview with Father Nate Wills, team chaplain, now, and then Matt and I will come back at the end of the show and preview the regular season finale at Stanford, make predictions. So without further ado, here's Father Nate.
One of the best parts of starting the independent podcast was a chance to pick the brands we wanted to work with. And Roback was at the top of our list. As someone who wears their quarter zips, polos, hoodies, and more, I can tell you the quality, fit, and feel is unmatched. You've seen Roback on Audric Estime, Michael Mayer, and Kyle Hamilton. You've seen it on fans at Irish tailgates all season long, too. While the gear hasn't turned me into an All-American player or grill master, Roback is still my go-to when going for a run, taking my kids to the park, or just lounging around the house on the weekends watching football. So make sure you're comfortable throughout the season with Roback. Go to roback.com/Irish for 20% off your purchase. That's 20% off for all customers at roback.com/Irish.
Hey, Pete, Thanksgiving is right around the corner. You know what that means?
Black Friday, family, food, football, the regular season finale. What do you got, Matt?
Exactly. It is Notre Dame's regular season finale at Stanford. It is a holiday weekend, and there's never been a better time to gear up with officially licensed Notre Dame apparel from Homefield. And the great news for our listeners is that first-time customers can get 10% off their first order using code INDEPENDENT23 at checkout. Don't miss out on the most sought-after Irish apparel available at homefieldapparel.com today.
Matt, what have you always said is my biggest weakness on fall Saturdays?
Well, Pete, I'd say your hair, but who am I to talk? Let's go with your wardrobe.
Harsh but fair.
ESQ outfits over 400 professional athletes, celebrities, and Irish players on game day with bespoke clothing that elevates their game off the field. ESQ sculpts every garment with precision, helping you look your best for work, weddings, celebrations, or in your case, Pete, the press box.
Listeners of The Independent can get 15% off their first online order by using the code IND15 at checkout. That's IND15, or visit them at their Chicago showroom for a full custom look. Head to esqclothing.com to create your perfect fit. Pleased to welcome to The Independent our first guest of the cloth, Father Nate Wills, team chaplain. I wrote a story about Father Nate about this time last year on The Athletic, kind of focused on the prayer medals, which if you follow along on Instagram, was always just sort of a fascinating thing. And we can get into that. But Father Nate, I really need to start with you and the fact that you're on the sideline during the game, so you have an up-close and personal view of what's happening. So did you see the marshmallow that was thrown at Sam Hartman from the student section, and did it in fact land in his hot chocolate? Can you confirm this?
I didn't see it fly through the air, but I saw Sam moments after that happened, and he was just like, and then he kept like, you know, hitting all the guys around him. He's like, look, this is what happened. And then he looks up in the stands, and there's this girl going, like, she clearly was the one who threw it. And he like points up at her, and then he like went to other people and said like, can you believe this? She threw it right in the cup, and she points up at the girl, and she's still there, like, you know, screaming. And it was really funny. So I think moments after it happened, I saw the fallout from it, which was pretty incredible.
Father, thanks for joining us. Can you tell us a little bit about your path and how you got to this point with the Notre Dame football program? And can you elaborate a little bit on the medals of the game that you give out to a player as well?
Yeah, so I'm an education professor here at Notre Dame, and there's really no good reason why I'm the chaplain for the football team. Honestly, Father Pete McCormick, who's our director of campus ministry, asked me to do this to help out a little bit with the other chaplain, Father Mark Thiesing, needed a little more help, so they brought me on, and this is my sixth season with the football team. This is my weekend gig because I'm, like I say, I'm an education professor, and I get to teach aspiring Catholic school principals in our Marianne Remick leadership program. So that's a lot of fun. And I inherited like many most things in football, I inherited this great tradition of giving out holy medals. It's funny when Pete and I talked about the holy medals last year for the great article he did in The Athletic, he was saying, you know, how far back does this tradition go? And I'm like, I have no idea. And then literally this summer, Father Tom Blance came out with this great history of Notre Dame, this book. And in it, it just says, you know, like, this is the first time that Notre Dame gave out holy medals was on October 13th, 1923. And I was like, oh, wait, that's 100 years ago this year. And so I was really excited about this, did a little bit of research into it, and turns out that Father O'Hara, who is this much-beloved priest on campus, who then became a cardinal, gave out these holy medals, and it was a really significant thing to Notre Dame played Army, and Army was having this this woman who is a Hollywood star do, like, the ceremonial kickoff, and Father O'Hara was like, you know what, they're going to have this Hollywood star do it, and Joan of Arc's going to be on our side. So he gave out Joan of Arc medals to all the players. And so this year I decided it'd be a good tradition to reintroduce that. And we played not on October 13th, but on October 14th. I gave out the St. Joan of Arc medals. And I'm not saying that was the reason for the victory over USC, but I'm not saying that.
I think it all fits together. I mean, I still, you were generous enough to give me the medal from the Clemson game last year, which I still have hanging above my desk. And I like following along on the Instagram account. Like, I was interested last week against Wake Forest. One, you referred to St. Xavier as one of the OGs of Jesuits, which I thought was a nice touch. But then I was confused why it wasn't Xavier Watts who was holding up the medal on the sideline. He went with a Gervonta Jean-Baptiste, which sounds like he could have been a French priest from back in the day, and Riley Mills.
Yes. Yeah, neither of them have the background. Look, it's a funny thing. Xavier actually held up a medal earlier in the season. I try to mix it up, who's doing different things. And sometimes there's a close tie, and other times it's because somebody had a really great game. I'll ask them, to hold the holy medal. That one, now, most of these things that I've taken on the traditions here have been things that I've adopted. The Instagram presence is, that one is my unique contribution to pray like a champion today. It's on Instagram. Anyway, I'll have one of the players hold the holy medal. And the first picture is always the holy medal itself. And then I kind of zoom out to show the player that's holding the holy medal. And it's a really great thing. I think some guys are like, yeah, okay, whatever, I'll hold the holy medal. Riley Mills was on the sidelines this week. He's like, oh, I thought you'd never ask. I really wanted to do this. That's so awesome. I was like, okay, great, buddy. Thanks. Here you go. And so, yeah, it's really great. It's been a fun tradition. I'm all out of medals from this last week. Like, I gave every single one of them away. So I think I had to start ordering more medals because people are excited about it, especially on senior day. You know, people want the holy medal. It's a great reminder. I mean, holy medals, I think we switch it to a different saint every week. And there's so much in the richness of the lives of the saints to look at, like paths to holiness and ways in which we can live out lives of goodness and holiness. And I always think the saints are a good reminder of that.
Xavier High School graduate here, Jesuit school educated. So, and everyone pronounced it right here. Everyone keeps saying Xavier. I want to correct them every time they address Xavier Watts in an interview. How far back do you go with Father Pete? How deep is that relationship? And I'll say it, why are you two the most popular priests on campus?
Now that Father John is stepping aside, I mean, it's...
Yeah, right. I know. Father Pete and I have been friends since the seminary. So we're the same age, and we came in at similar times. He came in out of college. I actually went through our undergraduate seminary program, but we've been friends, for years and years and years, like 20 years. So it's been, a great guy. Look, the reason he's popular on campus is really simple. He is one of the most generous, loving, kind people who reflects the love of Christ that I've ever met. He like just will give of himself like crazy. He'll, sign up for all this stuff. He'll do Baden Hall's whatever run and, Lewis Hall's whatever fundraiser. So they often invite him. He's really Notre Dame's campus priest. He's kind of the pastor of Notre Dame as the director of campus ministry here. And he's put himself in so many situations just to love people up, to minister to them, to be with them at really important times. He's the priest who does the opening mass for all of our freshmen. And so I think from the very beginning, they have this great sense of who he is. And the reason he's so popular is also very simple too. He's authentic. Like, he's just really, what you see is what you get. And I think it's not hard to see the love of Christ reflected in him to others. So I'm only popular because I guess I lead the Our Father at Mass, and I don't think I'm that popular. Though I did have to say, hilariously, the USC game happened the day after Father John Jenkins announced that he was retiring after this year. And I got a text after that game from my mom. She was very concerned. She said, "Nate, are you okay? They kept showing this other priest all throughout the game."
I said, other priest.
"That's Father John Jenkins, the president of the university. I'm fine."
It's good. It's good. It's good to know that your mom cares about you. I was interested sort of about, I mean, it's a bigger picture question, but just like the idea of, you got the Instagram account, game, like College Game Day, you popped in on that, like kind of like updating the priesthood with like social media and like sort of like being a little bit more out in front of it. And I even think about, you know, you mentioned Father Pete and Matt asked about that. Like when they show the call to mass on the video board, I think it is a really cool organic moment in the stadium where like people get fired up, and it doesn't say like, please cheer for Father Pete. It's like people are excited about it. And it just, I was into sort of this idea of, you know, kind of getting the word out in a very 2023 way, like coming on a podcast, for example, what, like why that's important.
Yeah. I mean, this is the new evangelization, right? Like I think it is, it's beautiful that I think folks invite us, to do things like this, to talk about, being a priest, our Catholic faith, the saints, you know, love of Christ and all these things. I couldn't believe Game Day let me do that. They basically let me like evangelize for a minute straight. It was so kind, right? And we got a ton of really nice feedback from people who said, you know, I was just watching Game Day and all of a sudden there was a priest talking about our faith. And I think this has been the case from the very beginning of Notre Dame. Part of the popularity of Notre Dame is because people who were Catholic were, you know, from in many cases in this country, looked down upon by other people. And they found a real hope in Notre Dame football when they started winning. And I think they took a lot of consolation in that. So I don't know. I think there's football and our faith have been tied together at Notre Dame since, you know, almost the beginning. But I do think that it's important to find ways to go out into the world. I mean, gosh, St. Paul did this in biblical times, right? When he went into the Areopagus, the Greek place of, you know, conversation and stuff. It's always important, I think, to not stay, you know, Jesus sent out his disciples into the world to not like go to the most comfortable places, but like go into the world. And this is where people are. I mean, people are, you know, finding places online. It's tricky. And a place like Instagram that can have so many downsides, you know, there's a lot of really clear data that like, you know, women on Instagram have lower body images and things like that. I mean, this is like studies that Instagram has done. So it's tricky to get involved in some of these media where you think like, I think I'm doing some good here. I hope it's a net plus. But I do think that it's important to go into the world where people are and to meet them where they're at.
Background wise, I mean, did you grow up an Notre Dame football fan? Were you a football fan? What's the ties, if any, to Notre Dame before you started working there?
Yeah, so I grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota. And my older brother, Nick, is a much bigger sports fan than I am. And he was the one who really, like, since we were young, is like, yeah, Notre Dame is awesome. Notre Dame is awesome. I'm like, okay. And, you know, my older brother thinks Notre Dame is awesome. Sure, I'll get into it. And I don't know where that came from, but he was always really excited about, he's like, I want to play basketball for Notre Dame. Okay. And by golly, he did. He got in here. We're both, you know, my brother, Nick, my younger sister, Natalie, we're first generation college kids. So it was, you know, kind of a stretch to get into Notre Dame. But, you know, my brother had great grades, ended up walking on for Notre Dame's basketball team, playing under John McLeod as a coach there. And so I really kind of, it's just transitive property that I became a Notre Dame fan. I'm my sports knowledge is, I would say, weak at best. I'm not very knowledgeable about a lot of things around sports, let alone football. I think there's a lot that I learn, and I'm really not here because of my sports knowledge. I played 1 year when I was in high school. I played 1 year of football. I was terrible. I don't usually talk about that much with the guys, kind of downplay that a bit. My buddy Bob Lair talked me into playing football my senior year, and we had a blast. It was a ton of fun. I ended up getting pneumonia and sitting out for a month of the season because I was sick, but it was all, I lived to tell the story, right?
Yeah. I was sort of, we talked about this a little bit last year in terms of your relationship with Marcus and getting to know him, you know, his spiritual curiosity, but also like, I mean, when he became the head coach, you were humble enough to be like, hey, like if you have your own ideas of where you want this to go, I'll stand aside. Clearly, you know, he wanted you to be a part of the program. What's just sort of your relationship with him like, and how does he sort of kind of lead spiritually, you know, as in terms of kind of embracing faith?
Yeah. Coach Freeman is awesome. I have just, you know, a million great things to say about him as not just as a coach, but as a leader, as a mentor, as a Christian, as a father. I mean, I think there, as a husband, I mean, there's all kinds of ways in which I think he is a person that our student athletes really look up to holistically, right? In every kind of way in his life. And I do too. I mean, I really look to, he's younger than I am, but I really look at the pressure that he has and the way that he's so gracious with people, that he always takes time to answer questions. And like, he'll always ask me, you good? You know, are you doing all right? And I'm like, I'm fine. I don't have a million people, you know, going to, you know, X and, you know, talking trash or whatever. There, nobody does that for me. And he somehow manages all of that with just a ton of grace and beauty. So I really appreciate him. I mean, I think there's a lot of business to do during the football season. So we don't get a chance to like catch up and chat, but there have been times when I'll stop by his office, just kind of, you know, walking through, and he always will welcome me in, you know, always talk about, you know, like, how are things going? What's going on? Ask, you know, really great, thoughtful questions. He's does something that's really important. I didn't realize how important this was until he did it, which was when new people come into the building, like when Al Golden came and he said, you know, we have these new defensive folks on our team. And I'm like, okay, great. Yeah. I'll go meet them. He's like, yeah, they're over in the office there. I'm like, okay, great. And he's like, no, wait, I'll come with you. I'm like, that's fine. I'm a priest. I meet new people all the time. I'm totally fine meeting new folks. And he's like, no, I'm going with you. I'm like, okay. And so we went over and talked to, you know, these guys. He introduced me to them. And I realized that there's a bit of an authorization that happens there among, I think, people who especially are new to a place and they really don't know, like, who do I trust? Who is, you know, who has my best interest in mind? And they're meeting a million people, right? And I think he's been really intentional about doing that with people and saying, like, hey, look, this is Father Nate. I trust him. We trust him to you know, be our spiritual mentor for us in our lives. And that's been just really beautiful. So, like, little things like that, he's just really thoughtful about. And that's sort of emblematic of a lot of ways in which he just leads so beautifully.
This might be a dumb question, but it is a Catholic school. A lot of people go there because of, you know, the religious ties. Are you ever involved with the recruiting process? Do you ever meet with recruits?
Every once in a while, I'll say hello. I don't work for football, so and I tread lightly on all of it. There's like a million rules around recruiting and stuff like that. So I don't really do anything until I'm asked to do something. I think they'll, I was shown there's a slide deck that they show incoming parents and stuff. And apparently I have a slide on there saying, you know, here's Father Nate and he's a resource for our team. I've talked to parents before who weren't sure about like, what is the faith component there at Notre Dame. To a person, I think all of them have been really excited. For example, like I talked to Spencer Schrader's parents last year when I think he was considering the portal and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Boy, they are some of the most faith-filled people I have ever met. And I saw them before the Clemson game, I think. And they just made a point of coming up to me and saying, you know what? This experience at Notre Dame has exceeded our expectations. And I think Spencer has found other people on the team who are deeply faith-filled, great friends, and people to share his faith with as well. And that's not uncommon that guys come to Notre Dame, not just because there's a phenomenal football team, but also just because they want to grow in their faith. And there's a lot of places to play football. There's a lot of places to become a better student and prepared for life. But there's not a lot of places where you can become smart, good, and holy. And I think that's a part of the draw to Notre Dame.
You answer to a higher power than the NCAA, my friend. So if you want to sit down and recruit visit, by all means, do it. No one's going to stop you.
I was going to say, like, pro tip, if you follow recruits on Twitter and they take a visit to Notre Dame and they post a photo of themselves with Father Nate, that guy's coming to Notre Dame, whether they've announced it or not. Just like, just an FYI there. So the last thing for me is last year, and I thought this was noble of you, you fell on the sword for the Stanford loss because you said that the prayer medal was Father Teresa, I think Avila, who you said, quote, she's Spanish, so maybe more of a soccer fan. Who will be the prayer medal this week? How are you going to like right the ship against Stanford to make sure that Notre Dame comes out on top?
Yeah, it's a good question. So Teresa Avila, it was actually her feast day. So like, I thought everything was coming together on that one. And I thought, boy, this is, how could this go wrong? I'm never going to point to, you know, the holy saints of God and say, it's their fault we lost. I mean, I'm just
a lot of Notre Dame fans. Well,
I'd rather blame myself for sure. I'm working on holy medals for this week. We had this one broke my heart. We had Our Lady of Guadalupe, who's just one of the best, one of the greatest saints, was for the Clemson game, and I like, my greatest worry is that I'm going to turn all these people like sour on these great saints because they're like, oh, that saint can't win. I'm like, no, Our Lady of Guadalupe is this amazing saint. I was going to say, I can't tell you of this week, but I actually haven't looked it up yet. I have this big box of holy medals, and I could find out for you in 1 second if you want to want me to look at my spreadsheet. But it's a kind of a funny thing because I end up Father Mark, the chaplain before me, was so great about this. He took off the little loop that comes at the top of the holy medal. Because like, no, that's not strong enough. They'll pull right off if the guys are wearing them during the game. Oh, okay. So he put these little split rings on each one, you know, like a keychain, right? So it has like, it's a really strong thing. And so I end up doing this for every single medal that we have. So it's like a long process. There's a lot to it, but it's fine. Here it is. St. Nicholas will be our saint this week. So a good one as we move closer to December. So yeah, so I got to put my little split rings on. I haven't done it yet. It's already Tuesday, but it probably takes me about an hour. And you know, it's a really beautiful process. I'll usually pray for the guys as I'm doing it. Pray for that saint's intercession a little bit. And last week I was doing it in my room in Keough Hall, and one of the students came in. I'm like, hey, Luke. And he's like, hey, can I help you? I'm like, sure. So I have this dream that eventually students will come in and pray together and think of this saint. And but I haven't done it yet. So
I've won, and I was told to ask this, and you could probably guess who told me to ask this. But one day last summer, you converted Coach Freeman, Ron Palace, and Hunter Bibben. And my question for you is, who has been the best Catholic of those three since they converted?
Look, I don't take credit for any of those guys. They've all had incredible people in their lives who have bit by bit really drawn them to the church, and sometimes over many years. I think Ron talked about kind of over decades. I've had the privilege of walking with them in over several years in each of their faith journeys. I got to do Hunter's wedding as well, which is incredible. I don't know. I'm not about to say who's a better Catholic, but I think, to me, all of them are great examples and witnesses. I happened to see Tommy Kramer on the sidelines last week, and he was Hunter's confirmation sponsor. And that's like such a special thing to have that just great relationship. And I don't know, I think all of them, I've heard all of them are faithful mass goers. So, you know, that they're on their own journey, and I won't say who's the better Catholic. I love them all.
All right. Fantastic. Well, Father Nate, thanks for making some time for us on Thanksgiving week to join the Independent. I will, I'll try to see you on the sideline at Stanford, this weekend. Should be a good trip, but, we appreciate the time and sharing some of your backstory and, how the prayer medals have come to be at Notre Dame. Cause I think it's one of the coolest traditions, this place, and this place has a lot of great traditions. So thanks again for making time for us.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks, Father. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks, man.
Ball placed between the hashes on the 19-yard line. Play action, drifting, throwing to the end zone. A diving catch is made by Eli Raridan. Touchdown, Fighting Irish.
Wow!
Terrific play action fake from Hartman as he drifted back to his left. He floated it to the back of the end zone on the left side of the field. Raridan sold out and dove to get it.
10 on the Wake 48-yard line. Play action sets up in the pocket. Wants to throw. Floats it over the middle. Complete. Down to the 20-yard line. 15, 10, 5. Touchdown, Jaden Greathouse. 48 yards over the middle. The catch and the run for 6.
That was Father Nate Wills. We thank him for joining us. I call that going out with a bang in the regular season finale, Pete. It was your call to get him on, and that was one of the more fun. Like, on paper, you wouldn't say, "Oh, the priest is going to be our most fun interview of the season," but that was putting myself in the shoes of an 18 to 20 year old football player. Like, that's like the guy who I'd want to go to with my problems and you know, for guidance, right? Like, there's this, and maybe it's, again, I'm a Catholic schoolboy at heart. Like, oh, I'm not going to go see the priest unless I'm in trouble. This seems like very, very welcoming.
Yeah. I think we reached our full potential with that interview at the end of the season. And I was glad that there was some confirmation of the marshmallow, because in my house, my wife has been all over me to find whoever this girl was who threw the marshmallow to see if that story actually exists.
She had to have like Instagrammed about it or something.
Right? Yeah. I haven't been able to figure out who it is, but, yeah, if you're a listener to the show and you know who this girl is, my DMs are open. Please drop
Pete Sampson asking college girls to slide into his DMs on the Independent.
That was also made clear to my wife. That's like, this, it's okay for you to advertise in this realm only.
About spiking drinks in college.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, that, it was fun. Like, I do think it's, and I asked about this in the interview, just like the fact that Notre Dame, you know, whether Father Pete or Father Nate are a little bit more like media forward with stuff helps. I think it just sort of helps the overall like accessibility, and like it, Notre Dame doesn't have to like apologize or like take a backseat to like what it is and what it's about. And I think they are great ambassadors for the school and the football program in a way that just makes everything feel kind of accessible.
Yeah. You mentioned it in the interview, but like every time I'm there, like, I don't think anything on the scoreboard gets a bigger ovation than that video with Father Pete. And it's almost like an instant recognition for all 80,000 people there. You know what I mean? Like, it's the same way like Wisconsin gets excited for Jump Around at the end of every third quarter, or Steelers like Renegade. Like, in Notre Dame, it's like, oh, here comes the Father Pete video. Let's go crazy. And it's pretty weird to like think about in that context, but they really do like look forward to that and go crazy every time it comes out.
It's definitely fun. So this weekend, Notre Dame wraps up the regular season at Stanford on the Pac-12 network. It's not. I asked Riley Mills about this yesterday because it's like Marcus Freeman has talked a lot about like reaching your full potential, and I asked Mills, like, is this, if you win out, do you feel like you'll have reached your full potential, or do you feel like this is going to be a season that no matter how it ends at this point, you're going to look back and be like, we were so close. And he said, like, you know, there is some truth to that. And it was, he framed it interestingly, though, is like, you look at the USC game and be like, that's the team we can and should be all the time, which is, I think, probably a healthier way to view it. This weekend at Stanford, I do think they have a chance to sort of be that team again. We saw that against Wake Forest last weekend, 45-7. Wake Forest had no hope offensively other than running a few trick plays in the first half. At that point the game was totally over. So I guess, how do you see Stanford playing out? It's, on the one hand, it's a team that Notre Dame should absolutely bulldoze. On the other hand, they were a team they should have bulldozed last year and didn't. And Notre Dame has struggled on the road. So I think there is some intrigue for me, at least, about can Notre Dame take the show on the road? Because they've really floundered at that all season.
Trivia. How many FBS teams are 0-4 at home this year?
Ooh. Well, I'm guessing Stanford is one of them.
The only one. The only one.
The only one. The only 0-4. Wow.
Scary, right?
Yeah. Wait. Is it scary for Notre Dame or scary for Stanford?
I think scary for Notre Dame because okay. That's just like, oh, wait, shoot, they're due. Yeah. I think we all think Notre Dame should go in there, should take care of business, should build off what was a fairly complete performance last week against Wake Forest. Wake Forest is a lot better than the Stanford team. And again, home road splits have been what they are this year, just 2-2 in true road venues this year. But you know, the line on this is 26. Notre Dame should cover it. I'm not saying they will, but even, you know, so they play there in 21, they blew them out. Obviously Kelly left after 19. Remember they struggled for about a half and then they just completely strangled
ugly. Yeah, I remember it was an ugly first half. And I remember talking to Ryan Harris, friend of the show, in the press box at halftime and being like, what in the world are they doing offensively?
That was right. That ended up being Chip Long's last game as OC.
Yeah.
We had heard for quite a while
that it was going to
the
be anyway
stretch of that season that there was some discord offensively, even if it hadn't really shown up on game day. And I remember watching that game thinking, okay, this is maybe like, this is where the rubber meets the road, but Stanford just wasn't good enough to really do anything about that. nor do I think they're good enough to do anything here. I mean, if you look at their wins this year, I mean, Colorado was incredible, but Colorado also is maybe the worst defensive team in the country. They won on the road at Hawaii and that's it. Just two wins in Troy Taylor's first season there. And I think he's a really good coach. I think he's building that program in the right direction, but I don't think they're anywhere close to being able to hang with a team like Notre Dame. You know, Ashton Daniels is a dual threat quarterback. He doesn't really scare me. Elik Iyomanner does, but they got to get him the ball. And I just think with the way Notre Dame's defense has performed, defense travels, again, even in those poor performances on the road this year, Clemson, Louisville, it wasn't the defense's fault, right? So I think if you go into this with a businesslike attitude, you protect the football, hell, run Audric Estime, go for whatever records are left for him to get. I don't see this one being particularly close. I've been wrong before, but these are two teams on completely different playing fields right now. And it shouldn't even be a discussion about the discussion should be, will Notre Dame win by 26 or more?
I could see Notre Dame's offense sputtering a little bit just because they have sputtered on the road all year. However,
but even then sputtering like three and outs or pick sixes, right? Like there are degrees.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, Notre Dame's offense might only manage three touchdowns and two field goals, but Notre Dame's defense is not going to give up 10 points or more. And it wouldn't surprise me if they scored. You know, it's like Stanford ranks in triple digits in yards per play and scoring offense. How in the world are, like, they're basically like Pittsburgh and Wake Forest. How in the world are they going to score against Notre Dame's defense? I just don't see it. Unless Notre Dame gives them the ball, which, like, look, at Clemson, I didn't think Clemson was good enough to score on Notre Dame's defense, which they did really on two drives, but that's it. The rest of it was the Tyree Muff. Notre Dame sort of got, there was a pick six, obviously. Notre Dame almost had a pick six as well. This is not, like, Stanford is not close to Clemson, which is not good on offense. They're much, much worse. So I just have a hard time understanding how Stanford scores 10 points.
The other part of it too, like it's a road game, but it's not going to be a road environment. Louisville under the lights, ABC. Clemson, for all their faults, is still a pretty tough place to play. It's called Death Valley for a reason. They pack that joint every week. This, it's going to be more Notre Dame fans than Stanford fans, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I've actually never been to that stadium and I can't say it's like a bucket list item for me, but it's not going to be a true road environment. The challenge will be creating your own energy, right? Which,
yes,
late game, last game of the year, not a very lively crowd. you know, not a bright stage, right? I mean, I don't believe Pac-12, like Sports Media Watch every week releases the top rated games or the rated ratings for every game. They've never had a Pac-12 network game on there because I don't think that data is available, nor will it likely be for the last game they ever broadcast. But I will go out on a limb here and say it'll be the lowest rated Notre Dame football game since those who track these things began tracking these things. So all of which is to say is like BYOJ, bring your own juice. Like this is, go out there. Don't take it for granted. For a lot of those guys, it's not that they're going to have a whole lot of bowl opt-outs, but it's still going to be their last time as this program, at least with this coaching staff, probably altogether. Leave no doubt, run the football effectively, play dominant defense like you have for most of the season, and don't give these guys any faint belief that they can even mount a comeback. Because, look, again, say what you want about Colorado. Any team that could be down, whatever it was, 29-0, I think, at halftime on the road and come back, is a tough football team. I'm not saying they're a good team, but they believe in each other and they're not going to tap out. And you need to do everything you can to combat that in a game that you should win by a lot regardless.
I think that it's worth, not that you need more evidence of why Notre Dame should win going away, but it's worth noting Stanford's big game was last weekend.
Yeah.
They played Cal at home. They sold it out and they lost 27-15 to a pretty bad Cal team.
Did you see the Trees tweet?
No, I did not. I don't follow the Tree on Twitter.
I don't either, but it got retweeted in my time. Cal posted a graphic about three straight wins over the rival. And the Tree retweeted like, yeah, and because of your broke asses, we had to drag you to the ACC. You're welcome for the lifeline or something to that effect.
Okay. So,
I love the nerd like trash talk.
Get on it, Tree. Yeah, I guess this will be an ACC game next year, not a Pac-12 game. But yeah, it's I just there's no reason Notre Dame shouldn't run away on this one. Stanford's not going to be a hole up at the line of scrimmage. They can't score. That's not a good formula to beat Notre Dame.
By the way, Jack Swarbrick got a sweet send-off last week in his home finale. Stanford should double that because without Jack Swarbrick, Stanford might struggle to field a schedule and a team next year. Like Jack Swarbrick helped lead the charge to get these guys. And he has.
It's Jack Swarbrick's alma mater.
Yeah, I was going to say.
His other one.
It's his other alma mater. He led the charge to get them into the ACC, which, as awkward and as weird as it is, was a life and program saving moment for Stanford football. Yeah. So they owe Notre Dame a lot.
Yeah. Well, I think that Marcus Freeman talking about this is a quote, unbelievable rivalry is also,
it was for a time. For
Stanford. We covered when it was an unbelievable rivalry is no longer such.
Like they were like, remember before 2012, like, oh, can Notre Dame ever be relevant again? Yada, yada, yada. It's like, like Stanford's doing it. Don't tell me you can't do it.
Yeah.
And it felt like Marisic that was
is scoring touchdowns on back-to-back plays.
That was the measuring stick for a while, right? Because of the way Stanford played under Harbaugh.
And who knew? They just had everyone's signals. So that might have been the secret.
David Shaw too, huh? I mean, they're smart. They would pull it off and they probably wouldn't get caught because, again, they're probably smart about it. But
there's something to be said for that. But, yeah, I like Notre Dame, I don't know, 42-7. That's, you know, not that different from last week. Last week I predicted 44-6 and the game was 45-7. So this week, 42-7. I'm not entirely sure how Stanford scores one touchdown, but I'm more confident in the 42 than I am in the 7. So I like Notre Dame to win going away on Saturday night.
So you got the under because it's 51.5. I'll go a barely cover in an over. I'll go 41-14. I think it's a garbage time touchdown at the end. But the biggest drama for me Saturday night will be making sure my free 7-day trial to Fubo TV works on my computer and making sure I remember to cancel it 6 days later.
Yeah.
They should have a Black Friday deal or something, right?
Yeah, they really should. I mean, it's probably, I could see their servers breaking down over signups on Saturday.
And everyone will get so mad and they'll say, well, we're folding, so you're SOL.
Yeah, exactly. It, It will be an interesting one regardless, but yeah, it does feel like kind of the end of the season, and the bowl game will be a bit of a coda for Notre Dame this year, whether it's staff changes or opt-outs, who knows. But Matt and I, we will return on Saturday night into Sunday morning for our post-game Stanford podcast, and please, Lord, let that be the only podcast that we do for the 72 hours following Notre Dame at Stanford, because last time Notre Dame went out there, that was like podcast central. We were talking to each other constantly. Some of it was recorded, some of it wasn't. But
some of it was you being like, "All right, I'm getting on the plane now. I'm going to the rental car.
Oh my god!
I just got this audio clip. Can you put this in the store?" That was a fun one. Like, I don't want to relive it, but it was like, those are the ones you look back on.
My kids still give me crap about not swimming with them at the hotel pool, and so we're staying at the same hotel on Monday night when I'm out there, and they're like, "You're swimming with us in the pool this time, Dad, like no excuses." And I'm like, all right, I feel pretty good about it. So
hopefully it'll
be a leisurely Christmas Monday.
I canceled Christmas tree shopping when we sat down at dinner and Kelly left, if I remember correctly. And that week was a blur. I don't remember sleeping. I don't remember. It was fun. I don't want to relive it, but it was fun to look back on. Also, nice David Shaw announced his retirement after the finale last year. So last 2 years, Notre Dame and Stanford finales have brought pretty significant news for both programs.
Yeah. Let this be back to normal times where, look, it's just a laid-back, business-like approach for Notre Dame.
I'm just saying, if Ryan Day loses to Sherrone Moore.
Stop it.
Ohio State fans might want a new coach there.
Well, there is a Marcus Freeman Zoom set up for Monday afternoon, just sort of like a beginning of the postseason check-in big picture thing. So yeah, hopefully Marcus Freeman isn't fielding any like huge big picture questions other than like, what's the future of the offense? So
what's the next first step?
The next first step. I'm saving that for the Royal iQuest Bowl if we should get to that
point. If you get Brian Kelly, yeah.
No, 100%. So on that note, we will wrap up this pre-Thanksgiving edition of The Independent. We will be back on Saturday. You can always find the podcast on Apple, Spotify, YouTube. Do you have any big Thanksgiving plans, or what's going on in the Fortuna household?
No, in-laws, eat well. Been traveling. I'm like you, traveling on Black Friday every year, so I don't get to experience leftovers. Although I'm seeing some family in Michigan that is a great group of cooks, so I will eat well. And then I'll go to Penn State, Michigan State Friday night just because it's in Detroit and I'll already be there. And then Ohio State, Michigan on Saturday, which candidly, I know it's the Notre Dame podcast, but it's probably the most excited game I've been for a game in person, maybe since the BCS title game between
Alabama. That'll be a fun one. I will be tuning in at 9 a.m. from a hotel in Santa Cruz, California to watch that. I texted somebody in Columbus, good luck against America's team as we're recording this. So that should be a fun one to watch, but purely just an appetizer for Notre Dame Stanford at night.
Me, you, and Jim Harbaugh. Well, I'll be watching it, you know, from wherever we are. I'll be in the stadium. He won't, but
good point. You'll be closer to the action than the head coach. So, all right. Well, on that, we'll wrap up there. Matt and I will be back on Saturday night, Sunday morning for a post game wrap up of the Independent as Notre Dame heads into the postseason. So until then, he's Matt of the Inside Zone. I'm Pete from The Athletic. Thanks for being with us on the latest episode of The Independent.